When it comes to the Koch brothers and their billionaire network, is it really about ideology or self-interest?
The philosophy of most of the members of the Koch network, they argue that it's better for America to get the government out of the way of business. But when you look at it closely, what you find is many of them have businesses that have tangled with the government, specifically with the legal system. And they have sort of very self-interested reasons. It's not really pure philosophy for getting the government off the backs of business. These people were poster childs for corporate malfeasance, a lot of them. And I think that's something, it's a reason why the public really needs to know who's involved in this group.
That's journalist Jane Mayer. We talk with her about her latest book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Then we replay part of our 2013 interview with filmmaker Tia Lesson about Citizen Koch, the documentary she co-directed with Carl Diehl. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Jane Mayer's acclaimed new book, Dark Money, traces the development of the Koch network from its origins. Mayer shows how the network has founded think tanks like the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and others to set the terms of our political discourse. It's taken over academia with Koch-funded departments and whole institutions like George Mason University, and established groups like Americans for Prosperity and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to write legislation, influence races, and buy politicians. The Koch brothers and their billionaire network is behind the creation of the Tea Party movement and other similar astroturf operations. It was also behind the case that led to the Citizens United decision of 2010. Dark Money makes clear, in vivid, meticulously researched detail, just how the Koch-topus has used ideology to serve itself, not only its profits, but also to avoid prosecution for flagrant violations of the law. The book should be required reading for every voter. Well, Jane Mayer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
This book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, at the center of it, but not exclusive, is the Koch brothers. And we're talking, there are four Koch brothers, but we're really talking about David and Charles. They own the second largest private company in America. They're the sixth and seventh wealthiest men in the world. Talk a little bit about their holdings and the reach of their holdings into the economic life of our nation.
Well, it's funny because Koch Industries used to call itself the biggest company that nobody's ever heard of. It's a pretty secretive company because it's privately owned by these two brothers with a couple other shares left over for one or two other people. But they basically own the whole thing. It does $115 billion worth of business a year. And even though most Americans aren't familiar with it as a name, they're very familiar with its products. So it makes Lycra, it makes Stainmaster carpet, it makes Dixie cups, Georgia Pacific lumber, and it has a huge profile in the fossil fuel world. It refines oil, and a quarter of the oil from Canada that comes into America is refined by just one of the refineries that the Kochs own, which is in Minnesota. So it packs a punch, but most people just don't realize that it's all coming from Koch Industries.
And I believe their fossil fuel holdings are some of the, I mean, I think as a company, some of, they're in the top 10, is that right?
They are among the largest polluters in America also, partly because of the fossil fuel businesses they do. But they are in among the top ranks of polluters in all three categories of pollution, according to a recent study done by the University of Massachusetts in Amherst: air pollution, water pollution, and climate pollution. And they've also been quite recently, according to EPA statistics, the largest toxic waste producer in America. So they have a very checkered past in terms of their record on environmental issues. They've been prosecuted a number of times for violations of the laws having to do with pollution.
Yes, and I'm going to get a little bit more deeply into that as well, because I found that some of the most shocking, I mean, I knew the vague outlines, but, you know, the criminal prosecutions that they've been, well, the legal trouble they've been involved with has been pretty vast and complicated. But now let's talk a little bit about the Koch network, because this book is not just about them. Early on in the book, you talk about a meeting by the Koch brothers, a summit that they called in June of 2010. Talk about some of the people who were there.
Well, this is a good point. And so people tend to sort of think that the Koch brothers are sort of the locus of political activism on the far right in big money circles in America. But the reason they're so important is not just that they're so fabulously rich and put so much money into this cause, but they've gathered around them a group of 400 or 500 other extraordinarily wealthy conservatives, which increases their throw weight tremendously. It's kind of like a magic trick. They've gotten all these other fortunate conservatives to put their money into a kind of a kitty and pool it so that they can have joint political ventures together. And who's in the group? It's a combination of a number of major fossil fuel figures. The largest private owner of coal in America is a member. His name is Corbin Benson Jr. There are frackers, from the people who use hydraulic fracturing to try to get gas from shale and oil from shale. And there are a number of major financiers. Steve Schwarzman has been a member of this group, and Stephen Cohen from SAC Capital. These are hugely wealthy hedge fund managers and investors. And some long-time and often privately held family companies like the Bechtel Company. The members of that family have been part of this group too, as has the DeVos family, which were the founders of Amway. So those are a few of the fortunes that are involved in this. And you know, each one has its own kind of dynastic story. But when they put their fortunes together, it really creates a tremendous war chest for the political activities of this group.
Yeah, and you mentioned Stephen Schwarzman, the CEO of the Blackstone Group, that's the biggest real estate investment firm in the world. Just recently during the campaign, in fact, I believe even this week, Hillary Clinton has met with the Blackstone Group a number of times. They're major donors to her foundation and campaign. I wonder if you could talk about the bipartisan nature of the establishment that it receives money from these billionaires.
Well, the Kochs themselves really are not bipartisan. They are, if anything, to the right of the Republican Party. So occasionally they'll give money to a Democrat, but usually it's a Democratic representative from some area where they have some business and they see it as sort of an expedient reason to back somebody's campaign. But both parties have big money, and both parties are reliant because of campaign financing on super powerful private interests. And as we've seen over the years, Wall Street's been a source of a lot of the funding for the Democratic Party, while it's also been a huge source for Republican Party financing, and as have many other big businesses. But, you know, this is, unfortunately, the nature of politics today, given that people need so much money to run for office.
Yeah, Citizens United being one of those reasons why. Now, about this group, though, still on them, you write that it was striking how many members of the Koch network have had serious past or ongoing legal problems. I wonder if you could give us some examples, not quite yet of the Kochs, because we'll reserve a special place for them.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is that the philosophy of most of the members of the Koch network, and they describe it themselves as a network, and they describe the secret members as investors, but the philosophy of many of these people is that they argue that it's better for America to get the government out of the way of business. But when you look at it closely, what you find is many of them have businesses that have tangled with the government, specifically with the legal system. And they have sort of very self-interested reasons. It's not really pure philosophy for getting the government off the backs of business. An awful lot of them had tax problems and other issues. Take Sheldon Adelson, for instance, who is a casino owner from Las Vegas. I mean, he was under investigation by the Justice Department for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is basically suggesting that there were allegations that his company had bribed foreign officials to get business. And issues like that were rife among this group. So there were a lot of, if you go down the line, there were an awful lot with tangled legal problems.
Yeah, I think Stephen Cohen of SAC Capital Advisors was accused of insider trading, although...
Well, the government never made the case against Cohen specifically, not a criminal case, but something like 7 people who worked for him in his firm were accused of insider trading or other kind of violations of securities laws. And his firm was described as having all kinds of problems along that front. These people were poster childs for corporate malfeasance, a lot of them. So and I think that's something, it's a reason why the public really needs to know who's involved in this group.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jane Mayer about her latest book. It's called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. And the Kochs, of course, because they are, because their holdings are so great in the area of fossil fuels, they've really gone after environmental laws. There's been a real pattern of lawbreaking on their part, and even people have died. I wonder if you could give us some examples of things that they have done and how government regulation has tried to rein them in and how they fought against those regulations.
Well, there was a horrendous case that was brought against Koch Industries following a pipeline disaster. One of their pipelines blew up in Texas, and it killed 2 teenagers who were driving nearby. And the families of the teenagers brought a wrongful death suit against the company and won. And the judgment was, at the time, the biggest one ever on record. Because during the court case, what came out was that some of the people who worked for the company said that the company was, to some extent, aware that this situation was dangerous and hadn't done enough to correct it. So the judgment took that into account, and it was just humongous. It was a horrible case. 2 kids died. There are a number of sort of workplace safety cases that have been brought against Koch Industries. I tell the story of the widow of one man who worked for the company for many years who died of leukemia that the widow said he'd gotten from being exposed to benzene, which is a carcinogen, at the workplace at Koch Industries. And the company kept fighting the widow, but finally made a deal with her and basically paid her off. You know, it's a hardball-playing company. And it has a history of pushing the envelope on legal matters, and particularly on environmental matters.
Part of playing hardball is also intimidation of people who try to either get redress in the courts or to expose what they're doing.
That is true. One of the things, it took a number of years to research this, but as I came across many cases of people who, when tried to challenge Koch Industries in one way or another, had felt themselves somewhat intimidated by people working for the company. Either they were whistleblowers, or in one story I tell, there's a former FBI agent who is investigating Koch Industries on behalf of the Senate, the U.S. Senate, which was doing an investigation of whether Koch had stolen oil from Indian reservations. And this FBI agent, who's named Jim Elroy, describes how he discovered while he was doing this federal investigation, he was tailed by someone. He'd never had this happen to him before as an FBI agent. And in fact, he tells the story, he stopped the person who was tailing him at gunpoint, pulled him out of the car, and the person said that he was working for the Kochs. So there are actually a number of private eyes who pop up along the way. The brothers, for instance, had something like 20 years of litigation against each other. They're four brothers, and they broke into two teams of two, and the two teams of brothers hired private eyes to spy on each other, going through each other's garbage. So, again, the tactics that are used by this group are very, very rough, which is why I think their influence in American politics is something that Americans deserve to, you know, be fully aware of.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about the secrecy as well.
Well, the company has this long history of being quite secret. Charles Koch's motto for many years, which he said he took from his father, was, it's when the whale spouts that it gets harpooned. So rather than getting harpooned, he would prefer to swim underwater and not be public about his activities. And so the company has kept its own activities quite quiet. It's a private company with no shareholders other than the brothers, really, and a couple others. And when they meet with the donor group, which they've gathered around them since about 2003 or 2004, they don't put out the names, and they won't release the names or even confirm the names of who their investors are in this political project that they've undertaken. They've sometimes gone to such lengths to kind of protect the secrecy that at one gathering they even posted sort of white noise-emitting machines on the perimeters in order to kind of make a crackling static sound that would keep the public and the press from being able to eavesdrop in any way on what was taking place inside the resort where the investors were meeting.
Now, what's been their impact on laws or the development of how campaign finance is done? I mean, Citizens United, I think, is part of this, but that aspect of it to keep donations secret, what has been their impact?
Well, you have to understand where the Kochs are coming from. What we're looking at now is kind of the result of a 40-year project that Charles and David Koch have been involved in, which is to finance far-right politics in America and try to help push the country in the direction that they believe in. And from the start, they've opposed any limitations on what people can spend in politics. They think the government should not be able to stop people from spending unlimited amounts. And so they've wanted to abolish, for instance, the Federal Elections Commission since 1980. So they've been helping finance, along with some of their friends, one lawsuit after the next that has challenged the limits on campaign spending in this country. And eventually, one of these challenges resulted in the Citizens United case that struck down the most recent campaign finance limitations. So they've been at this a long time, and when that case was decided by the Supreme Court in 2010, it really took the brakes off what can be spent. And the Kochs and their donor group really stepped up the amount of money they were pouring into politics exponentially.
So you say Jane Mayer in Dark Money, and you've just said here that this has been a 40-plus year project. It developed out of a three-part strategy that they've been extraordinarily successful at implementing. Tell us what that three-part strategy is. I'm thinking of, you know, on the one hand, starting with changing the ideology through think tanks and their work with academia, then weaponizing philanthropy, as you call it, and then promoting activism. Do I have those three right?
Yeah, that's one way to describe it for sure. What you have to understand is that Charles and David Koch are engineers. They graduated with degrees from MIT in chemical engineering and, in Charles's case, also nuclear engineering. So when they looked at American politics from their position far right on the political spectrum, they wanted to kind of look like engineers at the system and figure out how do you manufacture change, political change in this country. And they looked at it systemically, as engineers would. And they came to the conclusion that the politicians just reflect conventional wisdom. They don't actually create it. And that in order to change what political thinking was like in America, they would have to change the basic script, rewrite the script. And to do that, they came up with this kind of assembly line approach where the raw product that they would start with would be the ideas, and they needed to fund intellectuals who would create these ideas in line with their own thinking. Then those ideas would be turned into policy papers by think tanks, which would be funded through philanthropy. So these would be considered sort of educational institutions that are called 501c3s, and they would turn the raw ideas into position papers, which would then push for right-wing policies, and then those right-wing policies would be picked up by pressure groups that would be sort of look like grassroots citizens groups, which the Kochs would also help create, that would call for the changes that they were manufacturing in these position papers. And so you have groups like Americans for Prosperity, which purports to be a kind of a free market pressure group that's from the grassroots. In fact, it's organized and founded by billionaires, but at any rate, it reflects and echoes and pushes the policies that the Koch machinery has sort of started with in its think tanks and through its intellectuals. So it's a kind of a conveyor belt, and then what they do is they push to elect politicians who reflect their point of view and who will carry these positions forward and implement them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jane Mayer about her latest book. It's called Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. You know, one of the things that really struck me in reading this book, especially in this section where you talk about the development of the think tanks, for example, the Manhattan Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and the Cato Institute. I mean, when I listen to the news, whether on radio or TV, these are referred to just as they are. But on the other hand, if you have something that is coming from, let's say, you know, even the Brookings Institution, which is not particularly to the left, it's a centrist institution, it's always described as liberal. But there's never the descriptive of a conservative or right wing in front of the others. How much has their work basically made the political conversation the default one in American politics?
Well, I think that if they've had success, their greatest success is in mainstreaming what were previously far-right ideas and injecting them into the major mainstream conversations in American politics. So, I mean, sometimes people do define the Cato Institute, which was funded and founded originally by the Kochs. They define it sometimes as a free market think tank. But that sounds quite neutral. What it really is a far-right think tank that's funded by billionaires and large corporations that want to fight the regulations that are part of the kind of modern political system. And so they've succeeded, I think, in kind of confusing a lot of people about the neutrality of their ideas, when in fact their ideas are in many ways the product of and the promotion of private interests.
They've also reached into academia, George Mason University, for example. Talk a little bit about that. I was quite surprised that was an operation funded by this network.
Well, so what the Kochs have done, particularly in recent years, is to expand into academia in a really serious way. They want to change how future generations think about politics in America. They see, you know, the younger generation as the country's future. And in order to shape young minds to think like them, they need to reach them at an early age and in school, hopefully. So Charles Koch's foundations in particular have been pouring money into colleges and university programs. And they've now got something between 200 and 300 different programs in different universities and colleges, many of which, interestingly, are in public universities, which is what you mentioned. George Mason is part of the University of Virginia's education system. And, you know, many of these schools are strapped. They are facing financial difficulties, and they're hungry for outside donations that will allow them to expand into various areas. And so what the Koch foundations do is offer money in exchange for teaching pretty much their point of view. They do it subtly in various ways because most academic institutions are allergic to the idea of strings being put attached to what they teach. But by focusing the funding for programs on things like free market philosophy, they, in not so many words, shape what's being taught to kids. And that's what the aim is.
Now, they have also been shaping our legislative landscape, not just on the federal, but also very much on the local level. Talk about the American Legislative Exchange Council. I didn't realize until I read this book that it was formed as long ago as 1973. Tell us about them.
Well, you know, truthfully, I mean, and this, the book Dark Money is a history here. Hopefully, if people pick it up, they'll realize there's a backstory to how much started back in the 70s. It may have seemed that not that much was going on politically other than Watergate and Jimmy Carter, but in truth, there was a huge backlash forming in the 1970s to the environmental movement and to the anti-war movement and to the consumer movement and the public interest law movement, all the things that you sort of associate with kind of liberal thinking in America was creating a huge backlash among some very far right-wing corporate captains who were afraid that these new policies were going to threaten corporate America. And so they got organized in the 70s and started thinking about how to fight back. And in particular, Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice, wrote a paper in 1971 that was a kind of a call to arms to corporate America saying, we've got to fight back or we're going to be endangered. And so they started funding a number of institutions that they built specifically to kind of wage a war of ideas in America. One of those was ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which was the first money for it came from another of the characters I write about in this book, Richard Mellon Scaife, who was the heir to the Gulf oil fortune from Pittsburgh. And he put almost $1 billion into building up the right-wing infrastructure, according to his own account. I've gotten a hold of his private memoir, which was never published. And so I got to sort of eavesdrop on his thinking through that. And ALEC was part of that. It was aimed at changing the nature of the politics at the state level. So in state legislatures across the country, it gave the hand up to corporate interests that wanted to dictate policy in state legislatures. It's been a pretty well-organized effort.
And people may not realize that in the news recently, the Oregon standoff on public lands in Oregon, that there's involvement of ALEC even in that, because they have been very much pushing to put states in control of public land, something I don't think was really reported all that much on how that whole, you know, it seemed like a bunch of crazies out there, but it's really a fight that's happening over who's going to control public land.
Yeah, this whole sort of sagebrush rebellion has an aspect of kind of anti-government, right-wing thinking, some of which has been promoted by ALEC and by other groups associated with the Kochs, actually. They graze, they have a huge ranching operation and graze cattle on something like 400,000 acres of public land, and it would be more advantageous to them if they could just own the land. So, again, there's often an element of self-interest behind these projects.
Another thing you go into, Jane Mayer, in Dark Money is how they also have, of course, taken over our national politics, and they may think that the Republican Party isn't conservative enough to their liking, but they seem to have been able to exercise their will and power there. You write that the Obama's inauguration was barely over before a group of activists got together to nullify the results of that. And the first fight was around the stimulus. Is that right?
That's right. It took place while most of the country was paying attention to Obama's first inauguration in January 2009. The Koch group got together, that is Charles and David Koch and the investor group that they'd gathered around them of wealthy conservatives, to try to figure out what they could do to stop Obama from implementing the kinds of programs that he had been elected to put into place. They really looked at Obama as a cataclysmic event in America, this group. They're far right, and they thought he was too progressive. And they got together to try to figure out what they could do to stop him. And one of the first issues was, of course, TARP. People remember the bailout of the banks. It became the subject of a big fight during the Koch's meeting in that January 2009 period. And interestingly, most of the conservatives were against the government intervening in the free market to save the banks, but the Kochs were very quiet during this meeting and didn't say much about their own position. And it turned out, I found out while researching this, that while they had originally opposed the bailouts, their organization, Americans for Prosperity, their big political group, had quietly changed sides. When the stock market fell apart, which threatened their investments tremendously, Americans for Prosperity quietly went to members of Congress and said, you know what, we're in favor of the bailout now. Mm-hmm. They flipped on it, which is interesting for people like me who are trying to figure out, you know, are the Kochs really free market libertarians out of pure philosophy, or is this about some kind of self-interest? And in this particular case, they put self-interest above free market philosophy.
And that's not the only one. You write in the book that they take full advantage of federal subsidies.
Well, they do, and they've taken a tremendous number of subsidies. But when they do, they say they're doing it holding their nose, and they have to do it in order to remain competitive in the marketplace, and that they're really against such subsidies. But while they're available, they're going to take them.
How convenient.
Anyway.
And if you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jane Mayer about her latest book, Dark Money. It's about the Koch brothers and the network of billionaires that they've built in order to influence American politics and the legislative process. Now, I also wanted to ask you about Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor. You know, I'm not sure that a whole lot of people are aware of the connections, because Cantor and Ryan, you know, are treated as completely legitimate, you know, serious thinkers, serious politicians. Talk about them, and also, you know, McConnell, we're dealing with the Supreme Court right now. This whole campaign to stop the gears of government entirely.
Well, there was a choice, really, when Obama was elected, and it was debated within Republican circles, and actually in front of the Koch donor group behind closed doors, there was a big debate about whether Republicans and conservatives should be working with the Obama administration and trying to get the best deal they could, or, which is sort of the traditional way the opposition works, or whether they should just try to completely obstruct Obama at every turn. And it was that latter path that they chose. It was the path that was laid down by Jim DeMint, who was then the senator from South Carolina. And the donor group basically voted and decided to take that path. And so you can see throughout the Obama administration, there's been a privately funded effort by these billionaires and multi-multimillionaires to try to obstruct the Obama administration from governing at every turn. It's kind of a privately funded permanent campaign. It's waged not by elected officials, but by private individuals with a lot of money who simply don't like the government. And so they have, I tell the story in the book about how there's so many different bills and legislative efforts that when you turn them over, you find the money from the same group trying to get in its way.
And so finally, we are in the midst of a campaign where there has been a major insurgence from, if they thought they didn't like Obama or Clinton, how are they going to relate to Bernie Sanders? And I'm asking that question within the context of a very different phenomenon of social change happening around his insurgent candidacy.
Well, you have to believe that Bernie Sanders has got to be the Koch's nightmare. But I went to Wichita and heard Charles Koch speaking not so long ago, and he referenced Bernie Sanders as a dangerous phenomenon from as he sees it. So, you know, of course, this is something that they would be 100% opposed to. They don't like Trump either, for that matter, though. And I think, you know, pretty much every other major Republican presidential candidate has gone to the Kochs and their donor group and begged for their support because they have hold out the promise of so much money. But Trump is outside of that group, and he's self-funding, and it has stirred a lot of problems for them.
And do you think that in some way they have only themselves to thank for the current state of a Republican Party that has a Trump who may or may not be capable of being elected, but an establishment range of candidates who are very unlikely to be elected, and a popular insurgency that basically says enough is enough?
I do. I actually think that's exactly what we're looking at, which is that after Citizens United, the amount of money that flooded into American politics from billionaire and multi-millionaire donors who wanted to manipulate the political process in the country, I think that prospect has so upset many Americans who really, you know, feel that it's interfering with the democracy, that there's been a backlash that they've set off, and that backlash is helping fuel the candidacies of both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I just think most Americans probably, wherever they are on the political spectrum, whether it's, you know, far left, far right, somewhere in the middle, they just don't like the idea of 400 or 500 of the richest people in the country picking the next leader for them and deciding the course of the country. And so there's kind of a rebellion going on against it. And I think that's what we're looking at. And I think, you know, that they've created this problem somewhat themselves.
Well, Jane Mayer, your book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, is just a terrific read. Meticulously researched, exhaustive in its treatment, and fascinating from the first page to the last. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Jane Mayer is a staff reporter for The New Yorker. She's also the author of The Dark Side, as well as other books. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Dark Money. You can also read about how the Koch brothers went after her when they found out that she was writing the book, sicking private detectives on her in an effort to besmirch her reputation. Next up, Citizen Koch, the movie. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about the Koch brothers and their network of billionaires who are having such an outsized impact on our political process. In our first segment today, Jane Mayer talked about the secretive so-called social welfare organizations that sprang up like dandelions in the wake of the Citizens United decision of 2010. They claim their mission is education or some such social good, but as Mayer told us, their real aim is to further the right-wing extremist political agenda of shrinking government services for the 99%, destroying labor unions, and privatizing schools and other public institutions. One of the biggest such groups is Americans for Prosperity, founded and funded by coal and oil magnates Charles and David Koch. In 2013, we spoke with filmmaker Tia Lesson about Citizen Koch. It's the documentary she co-directed with Carl Diehl about how Citizens United allowed the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity to influence the political process in Wisconsin. David Koch was the biggest contributor to Governor Scott Walker's successful effort to hang on to a seat in the face of a recall campaign. That campaign stemmed from outrage at his all-out attack on public employees and their unions. Lesson and Diehl were supposed to air Citizen Koch on PBS's Independent Lens. They had an agreement with the company that supplies the films for that PBS series. But something happened on the way to your screen. Independent Lens caved to pressure from PBS, which was feeling the heat from the Koch brothers. So the showing was canceled. Jane Mayer reported on the controversy surrounding the cancellation in the New Yorker in 2013. The crucial question Citizen Koch poses is, who owns democracy in America? Well, Tia Lesson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like you to explain the title, Citizen Koch.
Yeah, well, we made this film set against the rise of the Tea Party movements and the rise of the Occupy movements. And we were looking at American politics today and the outsized influence that wealthy individuals and corporate interests have in our democracy. So the title's intended as a metaphor, really. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's also actually, you know, in the wake of Citizens United, there's certainly a lot of questions about what constitutes, you know, citizenship rights. And the reason why we chose Citizen Koch is Koch, first of all, figures in our film, Charles and David Koch inserted themselves into the story we were telling, which was the showdown in Wisconsin after Governor Walker started instituting these so-called reforms. They were the primary bankrollers for Governor Walker in the 2010 election, and their political organizing arm, Americans for Prosperity, was a primary backer of Scott Walker as he faced the recall. So the Kochs were very much involved in the story that we were telling, and not just them as individuals, but their corporation and their ideological corporation, Americans for Prosperity. So the idea of putting those words together, Citizen and Koch, I mean, the Kochs are citizens. In the wake of Citizens United, I think their corporate interests, both ideological corporations and business corporations, have been given citizenship rights. So, you know, we were looking at the obligations and the responsibilities of citizenship, and we think it's a really apt title for the film that we made.
In Citizen Koch, they're kind of like Animal Farm. All citizens are equal, but they're a little more equal than others?
That's right. Well, look, I mean, the wealthiest industrialists and billionaires seem to have, you know, especially in the wake of Citizens United, but of course before that, they have more power, more voice at the ballot box. They have more power in our media, as we've unfortunately seen from firsthand experience. And they have more power, you know, shaping public policy through the politicians that are essentially their patrons.
In the film, you spend a fair amount of time on the Citizens United decision and how it came about, and I was surprised. I didn't know that it had roots in a movie about Hillary Clinton.
That's right. You know, Citizens United, the organization, not the ruling, is a political organization founded in 1991 by Republican operatives who were the folks behind the racially, you know, loaded Willie Horton political ad that helped George H.W. Bush defeat Michael Dukakis in 1988. That was sort of a game changer in that campaign. It was a pretty shameful, despicable ad. And in 1991, actually, also that group oversaw a $100,000 ad campaign in support of Clarence Thomas's confirmation to the Supreme Court. So here, this, you know, right-wing group with a case in front of the Supreme Court had a decade earlier actually supported Clarence Thomas, one of those judges that would then rule on this case.
And you also point out in the film that it led to the funding of Clarence Thomas's wife. And talk about why that's a problem.
Well, look, it's a problem on all sorts of levels. There's a deep question, and there's a deep conflict of interest there at the Supreme Court. I mean, Clarence Thomas's wife is very much aligned with the Tea Party movement. Scalia spoke in front of the Tea Party caucus at the Congress, which is really beyond the pale. No Supreme Court justice has actually spoken in front of a political party like that. And both Scalia and Thomas had attended these biannual retreats that the Kochs put on for conservative donors. They're essentially fundraisers for the extreme right in America. I mean, getting back to Hillary the movie, Citizens United had made this film to challenge, essentially to challenge, you know, campaign finance laws. That's really why they made the movie. They were protecting the identities of their contributors so that they could put out this, essentially, this campaign ad, which was an hour-long campaign ad. And they took it all the way up to the Supreme Court, really as a means to challenge the McCain-Feingold bipartisan campaign finance laws. And we all know the result of that. The Citizens United ruling opened the floodgates to unlimited corporations, unlimited contributions in elections by corporations, including ideological corporations like Citizens United. What we saw in Wisconsin was you know, the ideological corporation Americans for Prosperity serves as, in some ways, a flow-through corporation. All sorts of other entities, individuals, and corporate interests can donate to that group, and there's no paper trail because they're essentially a 501c3 social welfare group. They claim that they don't spend the majority of their political activities on electioneering, and therefore they're not required to report, you know, their campaign donors. So, you know, look, there was plenty of big money in electioneering before Citizens United ruling, but this, I think, just changed the whole rules of the game.
Now, you mentioned 501c3, or actually it might be a 501c4. These social welfare groups are much in the news right now because there's a huge attack on the IRS, an office of the IRS that subjected these groups to scrutiny. I wonder if you want to weigh in on that in the light of this film that you made, Citizen Coke.
Well, I'll tell you that we spoke in the field, and it's part of our film. We spoke with Tim Phillips, who's a conservative political strategist. He's the president of the Kochs group, Americans for Prosperity. They claim to have spent $10 million in Wisconsin during 2011 and 2012. They claim it was not electioneering, but just as they're making that claim on camera, we pan our cameras over, and they're handing out flyers denouncing Tom Barrett, who is Scott Walker's challenger. They're ginning up Scott Walker. They're denouncing Obama in the lead-up to the November election. Their staff members have shirts on that say November is coming. I mean, if that's not election advocacy, I don't really know what is. I was sort of dumbfounded when he said that, and actually expected him to laugh, but he said it with a totally straight face. So, look, I think that Americans for Prosperity and those groups that have been really off the hook doing this kind of election advocacy without any kind of disclosure should be scrutinized. I think that what we got on tape would be enough to, you know, raise a lot of eyebrows. So I'm not really sure what the controversy is about. Obviously, groups on the left, you know, and liberal groups should be scrutinized as well. It should be across the board. But I'm not sure why anybody's surprised that a group that calls itself a party, i.e. the Tea Party, would be surprised that, you know, their tax-exempt status is being scrutinized.
Let's listen to that clip from Citizen Coke.
The days of the liberals, of the left, having this massive infrastructure that overwhelms us are over. It's a new day. We're saying to every governor and every state legislator, if you do the right thing, we got your back. We'll be there for you. We'll deliver the message with you. We'll knock on doors and make those phone calls. Frankly, we'll raise the money, and it takes a lot of it, but we'll raise it, and we'll put up TV ads and radio ads. We've got your back. Let's make sure that we do our part to move this state forward and to keep moving it forward. Thanks for what you're doing.
Here's your phone for you. Hannah will tell you how to get on the system.
Hi, this is Jeremy. I'm a volunteer for Americans for Prosperity. Just wanted to let you know that Mayor Tom Barrett has raised taxes in Milwaukee every year but once since he became mayor. Do you believe that Wisconsin is on point?
Thank you very much for your time. I urge you to go to Americans for Prosperity.
Do you think in the post-Citizens United world, do you have more freedom to do what
post,
you have?
No, it doesn't impact us at all. We don't do election advocacy.
Really?
Again, Citizens United impacts Americans for Prosperity in no way, shape, or form.
This is not election advocacy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tia Lesson. She's one of the two filmmakers who produced the film Citizen Coke. Her co-producer is Carl Diehl. They also produced the Academy Award-nominated film Trouble the Water. So back now to Citizen Coke. In the film, you spend a lot of time in Wisconsin. Why did you pick Wisconsin?
We went to Wisconsin because Carl's brother is a university professor there and a public employee, and he gave us a tip-off that, you know, things were happening there that were important and impactful and actually related to the story that we were telling. This was in early February of 2011. And when we got there, I think we were so blown away by the level of participation that we were seeing in the streets, not just by the usual suspects, but by across the board by outraged citizens from Wisconsin who were felt really betrayed by what Scott Walker was doing to the public employee unions. And what we learned the more time we spent on the ground was that the attack on public employee unions, it wasn't really about a fiscal crisis. It wasn't about wages and pensions and salaries, but it really actually was a political strategy that the extreme right was launching against the unions because of the political donations that the unions make to their political opponents, to the Democrats. So we stayed in Wisconsin because we thought that what was happening in Wisconsin had a lot to do with the impact of Citizens United. As you know, Citizens United freed up unions and corporations to make unlimited contributions from their general treasuries. And I think, you know, it essentially super empowered, you know, the wealthiest, but it also empowered unions to some degree. And I think in the aftermath of that decision, certain folks were interested in disempowering working people and working people's voices and the contributions that their unions were making. So we were fascinated with what was happening. We were drawn into the stories of three Wisconsin state employees, Republicans, who were struggling with their Republican loyalty when, you know, their unions were being challenged. And they were struggling with the Tea Party that they felt, you know, taking root in their state didn't represent them or their interests. So I think we were drawn into the story, and we stayed there for a couple of years to watch, you know, how the recall election was impacted by money from all sorts of groups.
And there was a huge amount of money, indeed. I was really struck, though, by how many Republicans that you interviewed. These were public employees, people like prison guards, teachers, somebody who worked in a facility for veterans, really powerful stories. Tell us about the prison guard scene. I mean, that was really striking.
Well, Brian Cunningham is a 17-year veteran of the Wisconsin State Corrections System. He was a veteran of the Iraq War, and when he came back, he went to work for a maximum security prison run by the state of Wisconsin. He was also a union leader, and he was also a lifelong Republican. He was living, when we met him, in Ripon, Wisconsin, which was actually the birthplace of the Republican Party. And what we learned from Brian, you know, who's a fiscal conservative and is very aligned, you know, with many of the tenets of the Republican Party, was that he felt that the party was not representing his interests anymore, that, you know, their attacks on his union, on him as a public employee, was alienating him, and he felt very betrayed. And he felt that the corporate interests that were donating to his party at the time were forcing, you know, people like him to make some very hard choices. And ultimately he chose to work to recall Scott Walker.
What kinds of choices at work? I mean, because He also talked about the impact of Scott Walker's policies, policies that are, you point out in the film, are being pushed nationwide by groups like Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers funded group. And the impact of that on his work, I mean, he said it used to be difficult to be a prison guard, but now it's impossible. What happened to his job as a result of Scott Walker's policies?
Well, what he tells us in the film and what we observed was that that Scott Walker's policies were impacting everything about his workday. First of all, inmate violence was up. Violence against correction guards were up. He said that the prison system just became a much less safe place, not only for him, but also for the inmates inside the prison. He relies on his union to help raise important issues about workplace concerns, and because the unions, you know, were disabled in large part by Scott Walker's budget bill, he no longer had that kind of representation, and he needed safety gear. They were told that they couldn't go into overtime, you know, when they needed to, and there are all sorts of just workplace changes that affected, he thinks, the very safety of himself and the officers he worked with and the inmates in the facilities.
There's a lot more in the film that we don't really have time to go into because I want to move on now to what has happened to the film. I mean, you had a deal with Independent Lens. It's a PBS show. It's been one of my favorites over the years. What's happened?
Well, we actually had a deal with the Independent Television Service, the folks in San Francisco who curate for the series Independent Lens, which is a primetime series aired on PBS weekly. And it is a series that shows really cutting-edge documentary films made by independent documentary filmmakers like myself. So we were very excited when we were greenlit last spring for a commission. And they were coming in with funding, and they were also hoping to air this as part of the Independent Lens series. Or if not that, then some public broadcast exposure. And everything was going along fine. They were very excited about the partnership as we were. But all that changed in November as in the lead up to Sundance. What we came to find out was that David Koch himself, who plays a role in our film, is a trustee and a major donor of WNET. WNET is a flagship station of PBS. David Koch is also a trustee and major donor of WGBH, another flagship station for PBS. Apparently, WNET was anticipating another large donation, a seven-figure donation from David Koch. This is what Jane Mayer reported in The New Yorker. And because of this anticipated donation and because of their relationship with David Koch, WNET came down hard on the Independent Television Service for another film that they aired in mid-November. It was a film by Alex Gibney called Park Avenue. So after WNET came down hard on that public television entity, ITVS, ITVS then killed the funding for our film. So our film was actually had been in the pipeline. It was actually we're editing in the lead-up to Sundance. And they told us point blank that we needed to change our film's title. We needed to take the name Koch out of the title of the film. And then they also essentially, you know, wanted us to take references to the Kochs out of the film. In other words, de-emphasize the Kochs in the storyline.
Because they were afraid that if they stayed in, then your film would not be able to be shown.
Well, not only would our film not be able to be shown in this climate at PBS, but the WNET had threatened, you know, according to Jay Mayer's article, WNET actually threatened to pull itself out of Independent Lens in the aftermath of the Alex Gibney film. So they looked at our film and kind of freaked out. And I guess we were the collateral damage. They desperately wanted to make sure not to piss off NET any longer, apparently. And one way they tried to do that, to placate both WNET and, by extension, David Koch, was to kill the funding for our film.
Tia Lesson speaking with Writer's Voice in 2013. She and her co-director Carl Diehl were nominated for an Academy Award for their film Trouble the Waters. They also co-produced Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, Capitalism, a Love Story, and his terrific new film, now in theaters, Where to Invade Next. Personally, I think it's his best. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.